The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Welcome. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. Beyond the Darkness is on the air. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Tomorrow, Ross Allison stops in with us. Oh, this is going to be fun. Make sure you bring the kids in for this episode, because tomorrow, possessed playthings, haunted toys is the topic on Beyond the Darkness. Yeah, it's going to be creepy, and we've gone deep to find a really creepy Theater of the Mind episode, so you're going to want to make sure you tune in and check that out. Now, Saturday, I'm also going to be hosting Coast to Coast AM, and I'd love for you all to check it out, join in. You loved when I had him on the show a couple weeks back here on Beyond the Darkness when we talked about the day Satan called. We're actually going to be doing this in a larger, longer format, and the phone lines will be open, so if you have questions for our guest, you want to know more about it, you can be a part of the show this Saturday, coasttocoastam.com/stations, and there you'll find all the stations, times, and areas that you can listen to the show. Or I encourage you to check out KNSI. That's the station right in St. Cloud, Minnesota, I'll be streaming from, so you can actually click on it and stream the show live so you can hear it anywhere in the United States. All right, so go check that out, KNSI, bookmark that and take that with you, or check out coasttocoastam.com/stations. Tonight, we're going to talk about something. I always find this fascinating. You know, we spend so much time talking about alien cultures and cryptids and ghosts and the demonic realm, but I'm fascinated by the idea of lost civilizations, secret societies, all of these wonderful things that have taken place before. How did they come about? What happened to them? Some of them seem so far advanced technologically and just in the way that they were able to do things and get things done, and then to just be gone. And their secrets sometimes gone with them. Well, our guest is here this evening to share some information and insights on secret societies of lost civilizations. Richard Cassaro is our guest. He's an author. He's a researcher, a filmmaker. He's from New York City. He came to international recognition back in 2011 with his best-selling book, Written in Stone, Decoding the Secret Masonic Religion Hidden in Gothic Cathedrals and World Architecture. His 2016 book, The Missing Link, Powerful Evidence of an Advanced Golden Age Culture in Prehistoric Antiquity, provides further evidence for his discoveries. His travel and life experiences have provided him with rare insight into megaliths, mythology, magic, symbolism, comparative religion, and occult archaeology. And all of his research is meticulously referenced and cited to a very high academic standard, which is a rarity among this kind of work and genre. He is a lifelong explorer and field investigator, and he's recently opened his own tour company. We're going to talk to him about that a little bit later on in the show as well. Let's welcome to the show Richard Cassaro. Thank you for joining us this evening, Richard.
Thanks very much for having me on, Dave. It's a pleasure.
So can I tell people where you're talking to us from?
Sure.
Yeah, all the way from Spain. You're bridging this gap. It's great to be able to talk to you. You sound like you're sitting across the table from me. I love this connection. But you just had power out for the last couple hours, you were saying.
Yeah, just in the building, though, and it rarely happens. Oh, so,
All right. What got you started into world travel and seeking the forbidden and hidden knowledge of all of these cultures and civilizations?
Always been interested in mysteries ever since I was a kid, you know, started out with the Loch Ness Monster and, you know, the Abominable Snowman and all this type of thing. And little by little, it just graduated up to Atlantis when I was more of a teenager. And that really made me very curious. I was also very interested in von Daniken's Chariots of the Gods, the idea that in antiquity that, you know, ancient aliens were in touch with ancient peoples. And so just kind of, you know, kept going from there.
Now that angle of it, has been something that has really kind of tripped the imagination of the world. When you look at these cultures from around the world, the Aztecs, the Mayans, the Egyptians, and so much of their culture, so much of their design and building structures seem to mirror one another, yet they're worlds apart. And there was, according to the stories we've all been told, no way for them to telegraph these informational bits of how to build these things and why they were setting things up the way they were. But it just seemed to kind of be a known fact, and this is how they did it. So many people, and if you watch the show Ancient Aliens, they'll have you believe that we had some help from universal overlords that were here teaching us this knowledge. Talk to me a little bit about that. I'm sure that having the fascination you just talked about, that had to be one of the first things that you kind of dug at to see if there was any truth or what you could find about that.
Absolutely. And in fact, I was interviewed on Ancient Aliens, a program in London about a month and a half ago in London. So, you know, I started out really believing that, and I'm talking about, you know, 30, 35 years ago, I really believed that, you know, there were similarities among cultures on different sides of the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. How do we explain that? And I always thought that I would be able to find evidence that these cultures were in touch with higher extraterrestrial beings, the so-called gods. And that's what really, you know, in the beginning captured my interest and my curiosity. But I have to say, you know, I really was interested not in proving what I thought, but in finding the truth and for what, you know, for me is the truth. I really was curious to find facts and evidence and really took an academic and scholarly approach to it.
Richard, let me ask you one thing then.
Yeah,
you go into it and you don't want to find your beliefs, which I think is fascinating. And that's what journalism should be, taking your beliefs and giving them the backseat and then just finding the truth of the matter and what is really going on out there. When you go in to look at this, can you logically see a thread that would, if pulled correctly, would make it look like we were getting extraterrestrial help? Or do you think that they are really stretching to put these pieces together and they might be forcing some round pegs into square holes?
Yeah, that's really what's happening in my view. And I've been studying it for many, many, many years. And like I said, I started out, you know, really believing that, but the evidence just took me far, far away from that conclusion. What the evidence really shows is that all the ancient cultures did have the same religion or wisdom tradition. They had the same art and architecture and artifacts. And in my books, I show that. And so, the idea that, you know, these gods, for example, the god Osiris in Egypt, or the god Quetzalcoatl in Mexico, you know, or Viracocha in Peru, you know, these are the main, the deities of these cultures. The idea that they were extraterrestrials just doesn't make sense. What the, traditions of these cultures really shows is that, you know, it talks about who we are as spiritual beings rather than as extraterrestrials. It talks about the fact that we have a higher nature within us, a spiritual nature, a deity within us, which is who we really are. You know, we've all heard the expression, we are spirits in the material world. That's really what these deities are talking about, this whole concept of, you have to find the deity within yourself, and that's what Quetzalcoatl represented in Mexico. That's what Viracocha represented. That's what, find the Osiris within you. And even in our modern religions and esoteric Christianity, the idea is to find the Christ within. And you'll find that in all the occult books and the esoteric books that have come down to us, you know, over time. So this isn't just an idea that we've had in the last 100 or 200 years. This is an occult tradition, an esoteric tradition that's been around with us for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years and known to, you know, kings, nobles, mystics, really of all ages.
Well, all right. Let me ask you this then. If we look at the metaphysical aspect, one thing that they talk about is this universal mind, this global consciousness. They've even talked about the Akashic records, that there's this kind of world base of knowledge that exists, and it's just learning how to tap into that. Do you think there is something to that? And was it in finding their own inner God that connected them, and how these different cultures would represent the same imagery in their own way and the same building structures and the same kind of belief systems?
Well, that's interesting. It's an interesting way to look at it. And I think, you know, according to the occult tradition that I've latched on to and that I talk about in my books, the idea here was that there was a golden age in the remote past. And this is something that you find in Hinduism and in Greek mythology and Roman mythology. So, and not just buried somewhere. This is a major part of Hinduism. This is a major part of, you know, Greek, Roman, even the Aztecs. A lot of cultures talk about the idea that in the remote past, thousands and thousands of years ago, there was a golden age. During this golden age, mankind was much, much more advanced than we are today. Much more, and not in a technical sense, not in the sense that we had, you know, access to advanced machines. We were spiritually advanced. We had higher minds. We had stronger minds. We had, you know, all kinds of powers related to that, powers of the third eye, sixth sense powers, that type of thing. And so according to this tradition of antiquity and of the esoteric, you know, schools, the Golden Age fell into the Silver Age, and the Silver Age fell into the Bronze Age, and then the Bronze Age fell into the Iron Age. And that's, and pretty much what we're living in today is the Iron. The Hindus call it the Kali Yuga. It's the worst of all the ages. And when I started to really, you know, many, many years ago, when I started to really believe that, that these teachings were correct, it really made a lot of sense because, I mean, we're living in a, what I see to be a tough time, you know. Whereas when
we
look
at
that's
a fascinating aspect, right? You're looking at the Golden Age is this time when there was slavery, there was no air conditioning, there's no way to connect to the rest of the world. You kind of lived in your own little pods of people and belief systems and under dictatorships. And they consider this kind of the Golden Age of society. And then as we look now in 2017, many of us would consider, wow, we're finally in the Golden Age. Look what we can do medically. Look what we can do technologically. Look what we can do with all of the different opportunities that we have available to us. But you're saying that kind of the way history looks at us in the future and through time is that we are kind of, I mean, we're one step above the aluminum foil age, it seems like, right?
Absolutely. We've fallen. It's the complete opposite of what we've been taught all along. We've fallen from the Golden Age. We've fallen through, you know, what the Hindus called the Golden Age, the Satya. Then we've fallen into the silver from there. That's the Treta. Then into the bronze, which is the Dwapara, and now into the Kali Yuga. And that's where we're in now. So what we're taught in school is that, you know, we've risen from the apes and we've pretty much evolved from cavemen into space travelers. And we're now at the pinnacle of our civilization. And what I've found with this, with these esoteric and occult traditions and what the ancients themselves tell us is the exact opposite is true. Our technology is masking the fact that we're in a dark age. We've fallen spiritually, and in that sense, we've fallen in the sense of not being psychologically aware of who we really are. We have amnesia of who we really are. Our spiritual, true spiritual selves, our higher selves, as they call it, the soul within. We're much more materialistic. We're living in a material age, and that's the technology aspect of it. And so, yeah, that's when I really started to believe that and see that, and I started to look at ancient cultures, that's when all the similarities really emerged. And that's when I found that they all had this same wisdom tradition, and they expressed it with the same architecture, the same pyramids, the same mummies, the same corbel vault architecture. I found my own self personally, I found what I call the triptych temple and lots of other parallels. And these parallels show that during the Golden Age or during one of the, you know, higher ages of the past, that there was a universal tradition that everybody followed. And that's, you know, that's pretty much the thrust of my research. And that's something that a lot of people today, it's hard for them to grasp, and it's hard to them for them to accept. And I understand that, like I said, because we've been taught one way, and to actually just let go of that paradigm and see things a completely different way is very hard for most people.
You said that you believe that they're pulling strings and trying to force round pegs into square holes when they're coming to things like the alien interference and that, but yet there are these strange hieroglyphs that are seen all around the world, and I don't even know if that's really the right term in the other cultures, pictograms and other things that seem to show very similar bird-like creatures or gods that have come down and interacted with the people. what exactly do you think these are? Are these fables? Are they representations of ideals? Or are they structured formal teachings of this is what happened?
Yeah, you know, I don't completely count out the idea that we've been visited by extraterrestrials, or even the idea, which most people don't really talk about, the idea that we have sort of a relative on this planet that's from this planet that we just don't know about, that keeps themselves hidden from us. I mean, there's so many possibilities, but the idea here is that, you know, what you're saying, you know, the things that you're referencing. I think it's very possible that ancient peoples had contacts and had, you know, but not to the point where that they were the gods, that they were the ones who created all the civilization, that they're the ones leading. And I mean, it just gets way out of hand at that point. So, you know, I don't discount the idea that there's been contacts and that there's, you know, crazy, wacky things happening in the world. And I think that there definitely is, you know, angels, what we call angelic beings, demons, that type of thing. But I don't think to the degree or the extent that it's guiding civilization or and having a major impact on our civilization. I don't see that, and I don't think it's not expressed in the esoteric or occult tradition, the secret societies. It's just not expressed in that body of literature, and so it's not something that I really talk about or think too much about.
I know a few days ago we did an episode on forbidden knowledge of the supernatural, and we talk about, even in Christianity, that the story of God that we get is most likely not the right story. Do you see in all of these different cultures and subcultures, what is the need? If we truly have this divinity within, why do we all feel the need to create a god or a godlike structure above us to rule over us or to follow by? Why do you think that, you know, that exists in all of these different realms?
Well, in the, you know, the Western and the Eastern, you have the Eastern religions of Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, and those types of religions where the idea is that the God is within. We are the God. We are the divinity. We have the divinity within ourselves. We have the spark within, and we are all powerful, all knowing already. We're the spirit, we're the soul, we're the higher self. And that's exactly what the esoteric and occult tradition teaches. In the West, however, starting with the biblical tradition, Judaism, and then Christianity, and then Islam, they take the God within and they push it out. They push it outside and they say, you don't have that divinity within. That divinity is external to you. And so that's the major, major difference between the Eastern religions and the Western religions, and it's a massive difference because it changes everything. The idea among, you know, in the research that I've studied, in the occult tradition that I've studied, the whole reason for it is because what an easy way it is to control masses and masses of people by saying, hey, you know, you were born in sin. There's a God up above. And the only way that you can be redeemed of your sin is through the church, through us. And so, you know, follow what we say. We're the authority. Submit to us. And they pretty much did that for the past 2,000 years. That's the legacy of Christianity with the Inquisition and all the different groups, etc. And so that's the reason, in my opinion, and you know, that's what the research shows, that they externalize the deity, that, you know, it's a very easy way to control a lot of people and make them do what you say.
You mentioned at the beginning of our conversation Atlantis, and that's something that's really kind of been a cool idea and imagery and story. But again, they track the story to Plato, and that he is the one that spoke of this. Now, it sounds like he's the father of Atlantis because he was the one that spoke of this story. But if this culture and society existed, why was Plato the only one describing it? Or was it other people did and other people talked about it, but nobody had the notoriety of Plato?
Well, a lot of the Greeks talked about Atlantis. Plato was the most famous, but You know, as I say in my books, there was Crantor, there was Proclus, Zauticus, Posidonius, Strabor, and several others, Greeks, Romans, they talked about Atlantis. And so it wasn't just Plato. It was more common than most people realize, like this concept of Atlantis. And so, you know, for many years when I was younger, I thought Atlantis was just a myth, just a metaphor, just an idea to convey the concept of the Golden Age. But probably for the last 15, 20 years, I've really believed that there really was, that he really was clued in. He had keyed into a real truth. And that's the reason for these parallels among ancient civilizations, because there was a mother culture. The cultures that we call the first cultures, you know, the pyramid cultures, what I call the pyramid cultures, the Aztecs, the Maya, the Olmecs in Mexico, the Inca and pre-Inca in Peru, the Egyptians, the Chinese, the Hindus, the ancient Europeans. I mean, they all really had the same wisdom tradition. And to me, what's very clear is that they were all children of the same mother culture. And that story is remembered in different ways. The flood myth, the concept of the Tower of Babel, where the confusing of the tongues. It's really also conveyed through the esoteric and occult tradition. It's just there. You see it through the different philosophers and writers on down through the ages. It's a very accepted concept in the esoteric tradition. It's been even accepted in academia. The Victorian scholars of the 1800s believed in it. And, up until probably about 1930, 1940, which is not too long ago, scholars believed in Atlantis. A lot of archaeologists believed in Atlantis, and they found evidence for it. And, you know, not just the crazy, wacky scholars or the fringe scholars, real scholars, the real deal scholars, they believed in it. So it's only really the past 50, 60 years that academia basically says, look, there's no evidence for it because we can't find an island anywhere in the Atlantic Ocean where it's said to have existed. That's their main claim. But the idea that my research follows is that, you know, look at the similarities among ancient cultures. I found the same religion, I found the same architecture, and I've, you know, pushed the argument much, much further along because I've found things that nobody else has, which I've published in my research, in my books.
You would think at this point, with the abilities that we have to map the Earth and see below the water and all of this, there would be some kind of real academic evidence to prove that Atlantis or civilizations like that existed. You said that there has been. What can you point us to that would, you know, at least get us on the right track to say, oh yeah, there is that? I mean, we understand there are some cultures, especially near the oceans and along the coastlines, that have sunk and have been taken over by oceans and because of the polar shifts and everything. So we understand that some of that happened, but does that necessarily mean that an Atlantis existed?
You know, it's tough to say because I'm not really looking for the actual physical evidence. I don't think there will ever be found. I don't think any physical evidence will ever be found. I think that the cataclysm or the catastrophe, whatever it was that had wiped out Atlantis or the mother culture, the Golden Age culture, was so severe that you know, no traces of it remain. What I think that we do see is among the ancient cultures that do exist, like, for example, in Peru, we see architecture that is amazing and that shows us that it was not created by ordinary men. It was not created by ordinary people. That the stonemasons who created those structures had something that stonemasons today just don't have. People today, they were in touch with powers that people today just don't have. And we see that all over the world.
You've got these rich secret societies like the Masons that have the claim to have been there since the beginning of time. Why has this knowledge not been carried forth?
Well, it has. It has been carried forth. It's been carried forth through the Freemasons. And that's something that I talk about in my book, Written in Stone. The concept here is that all the ancient structures in the world that that today a lot of researchers, not just myself, a lot of other researchers are pointing to and saying, hey, this is advanced stuff. The Great Pyramid of Egypt, even the other pyramids, it's not just the Great Pyramid. There's a lot more pyramids there that are just as amazing. You know, the polygonal and cyclopean ruins in Peru, the cyclopean ruins across Europe, there's tremendous advanced stone ruins built in stone that that show us that there was an ancient tradition of stone masonry. And in modern Freemasonry and the concepts that we've inherited in Freemasonry, they talk about the idea of the ancients had higher powers. They had access to the higher powers. It's a very simple concept. The modern Masonic symbol, the most important Masonic symbol, or one of the most important, is the third eye. That's the all-seeing eye. A lot of people confuse it. They say, oh, it's the eye of God. Not the eye of God at all. It's the third eye. The reason why it's in the triangle like that is because it goes back to the ancient Hindu concept of Ida, Pingala, and Sushumna, which is how you awaken the third eye. You balance the two, and then the third one grows out of the balance. And so the eye in the triangle is, which is the Masonic symbol, is the third eye. It's really impossible. Once you've done the research, once you've seen it, it's impossible to refute. And so what I've found is that that the Freemasons who have this symbol of the third eye, and by the way, it's just not the third eye. It's all the Masonic symbols. They all work together. They all fit together like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. What they show is that the modern movement of Freemasonry has or is putting forth symbolism that shows how we moderns can get back in touch with the higher self, how we can tap higher powers, sixth sense powers, how we can awaken the third eye, and really, find something within our nature that is a much higher aspect of ourselves. And that's how they did it. That's how the ancient peoples did it. That's why they created those monuments that today we look at and we say, geez, look like aliens built it. It wasn't aliens. It was men, but a higher form of man. Plato talks about it. The Greeks talked about it. Hindus have a dot on the forehead, which is symbolic of the third eye. The concept, according to the occult tradition, the concept is that during the Golden Age, man was much more in touch with his third eye. And slowly as the Golden Age fell into the silver and kept falling, this organ, started to close up we started to have less contact with this organ. Now, I'm not saying that people had an actual third eye on the forehead, although I think anything is possible, but I the way I look at it is we just had a much higher, we were much more in touch with our true nature, and we were able to see with the third eye. We were able to see that true nature, that divinity within ourselves using the third eye. The two eyes see outward at the material world. The third eye sees inward and sees the divinity within, sees the God within, the soul within. Hindus, when you walk into the home of a Hindu, they put their hands together in prayer and they bow to you. Why? Because they're bowing to the God that's within you. That's who you really are. Joseph Campbell talked about that, the mythologist of the 20th century. A lot of people, Carl Jung, a lot of people talked about this, and they were really top of the line researchers. It's not a fringe or any type of an alternative. This is it. This is history. This is the real deal.
I like that idea that this existed, that we had this kind of oneness, this all-knowing and kind of connected third eye and abilities to do these things when we weren't getting in our own way. What I have a hard time understanding is, how do we go from such an advanced culture? How do we go from this ability to do miraculous things with limited capabilities of the time to where we're at now, and there seems to be this huge drop-off? Even though technologically and medically we've advanced in these other areas, why is it that this other ability became a recessive gene? We'll discuss that more with our guest, Richard Cassaro, as we continue the show this afternoon. And we got to take a quick break. We'll come back. We've got more. We got to talk about these lost civilizations. We've got to get some more answers because, again, there are so many different fascinating angles on this, and we haven't even scratched the surface. We'll do that when we return right here on Beyond the Darkness.
Beyond the Darkness.
All right, we're back here on Beyond the Darkness. Richard Cassero is our guest this evening. He's an author, researcher, and filmmaker from New York City. He's currently in Spain. We're going to talk to him a little bit later on in the show. Why is he in Spain? What has he uncovered? And we'll discuss that. It's very fascinating stuff. But today we're talking about secret societies of lost civilizations. Where did this knowledge go? Where did it come from to begin with? And how long did it take us to get there? So we'll discuss this and more as the show progresses. Let me start off there, Richard, just so we can kind of launch back in and bring people up to speed. We hear about this golden age when they were doing this and they had this kind of understanding. How long did it take them from knuckle dragging, you know, dinosaur riding people to this golden age culture?
See, I don't see it like that. According to the tradition that I've latched onto, as I said before, this is just something where the further back in time you look, the more advanced civilization is. And we see that in the ruins. I mean, look at the Great Pyramid of Egypt. There's so much mathematics encoded into it. And just standing there in front of it, you could see that it's just something that doesn't look man-made. I mean, you've heard so many people saying that they believe aliens built it, and there's a reason for that, because the thing looks futuristic. And believe me, I mean, standing inside of it is even more amazing. So, and again, not just the Great Pyramid, but lots of other pyramids in Egypt and lots of other structures across the world. So I don't see it where there was, a barbaric age that evolved into the Stone Age, although that's what the teachings say. I mean, the way I research it is I see the monuments that we have in front of us today, and I see them stretching back probably to the Golden Age, or if not the Golden, then perhaps a more recent age, but definitely an age when men was more advanced than we are today. So I don't, that's the extent of what my research. That's the way I look at it. Instead of seeing the ancients as dumb or cave people or anything like that, I don't see that at all. Look at in Peru, they had brain surgery, trepanation, they called it, and the people lived, and the bone grew back. I mean, how do you explain that? That's not a primitive people. That's a futuristic people. There's a lot in Peru, actually, that I could point to. A lot in every civilization that we can point to. But the most important part, the most powerful things that we can find are the stone monuments that they left behind, the dolmens, the aqueducts, the pyramids, the Cyclopean ruins. They're all over the world. And this is what we look at, and this is what we see, and this is why I say that we've fallen from this time. We've not evolved forward. We've fallen.
You've looked at a lot of the similarities, and we've briefly touched on those in the beginning segments of the show. But have there been a few common threads that really stand out to you regarding all of these different cultures from around the world, and what would those be?
Yeah, well, when I was in my late teens and 20s, I had started contacting scholars about what I believed were the similarities. I started to find similarities that nobody else really saw. They were minor similarities, but, I was talking to museum curators, I was talking to professors, and I would attend lectures and that type of thing. I was starting to really get interested. But, they said, well, why are you interested in these similarities? And I'd say, well, at first I thought it was because aliens were in contact with different peoples around the world. They would roll their eyes at that. And then I would say, but lately I'm really starting to think that there was a kind of a mother culture in the remote past, and that these similarities are evidence or remnants of this mother culture, and that the cultures that we see as the world's first cultures, the so-called pyramid cultures, they are the children of this mother culture. They rolled their eyes at that as well. And I would say, well, why? I don't get it. I don't understand. What is so bad about that? Well, there's no evidence for it. And I thought, well, that's my job then. My job is to find evidence for that. And that's when I really started to travel in earnest and look around the world for these things. I went everywhere that I could possibly go. I went to Egypt. I went to Peru, Mexico, through Europe, etc. And what I found was what I think is the most incredible evidence for the existence of a mother culture, and that's the Triptych Temple. That's what it's featured in my book Written in Stone. What it is basically is it's a discovery of the fact that the ancient pyramid cultures all built the same temples. And these temples are three-door temples. And if you Google, you know, listeners out there would Google it, Triptych Temples, T-R-I-P-T-Y-C-H, temples. There's a meme or a meme or however you say that word. There's a meme out that's from my work. It's from my book. A lot of people have seen it. But they don't know it's where it comes from. That's me. That's my work. That's my discovery. It's the fact that ancient cultures all over the world, from Egypt to Peru to Mexico, China, India, they all built these three-door temples. And what it stands for is the idea that we are spiritual beings, that the number three is actually a very important and powerful Masonic number. It stands for what's called the balance of the opposites, the reconciliation of opposites, the reunion of opposites. The idea here is that in Latin it's called coincidentia oppositorum. What it really means is the ancient yin-yang, for example, everything in creation is made up of a duality. Light is opposed by darkness. Good is opposed by evil. There's man and woman, up and down. There's the whole world, the whole physical world, creation itself is made of opposites. And this is something that you'll find in every single ancient culture, bar none. The Greek philosophers talked about it, the Hindus, the Buddhists, everybody. This formed the foundation of every ancient culture, religion, cosmology, and everything. So the world itself, the physical world, creation, is made of light and dark. It's represented by the sun and the moon. But in the middle of this, there's a bigger door. These opposites are symbolized by the twin outer doors of the Triptych Temple. The two outer doors are kind of the same size, whereas the middle inner door is wider and larger. That's the source. That's the spiritual source. Whereas the duality is a physical manifestation. The outer twin doors are a physical manifestation. The inner centered door is a spiritual, is the idea that we've all come from a spiritual source. A very cool thing here, many, many years ago when I was standing in front of Rockefeller Center in Manhattan, and if you Google Rockefeller Center, you'll see it's where they put the Christmas tree every year. There's a massive triptych there. On one side, on one of the doors is a woman, the image of a woman. On the other side is the image of a man. That's the duality. Then in the middle door, which is taller and wider than the two doors flanking it, the middle door is an image of a god, the deity, the source. That's a very powerful image. Whoever designed that knew exactly what the triptych means. And if you look very closely, that deity has a Masonic compass in his hand, in his right hand, thrust downward. And so there's evidence right there of not only the fact that that the triptych is a powerful and important discovery for antiquity, but also that the idea has been passed on through the ages and has reached us today. I also found the triptych in all the secret society headquarters. If you Google Skull and Bones Crypt in New Haven, Connecticut, you'll see the triptych encoded in the doorways. The Knights of Pythias, triptychs all among their lodges and halls and temples. Almost every Masonic temple has a triptych in some way. Usually it's right in the front, built into the architecture. Most secret societies, the Shriners, they have, and their headquarters and their halls and lodges are built with triptychs. And so that's evidence of the fact that these secret societies have inherited the ancient universal religion of the Triptych Temple that was once shared by all the pyramid cultures on Earth. And that's all I talk about that in my book, Written in Stone. And that's the evidence that I found, you know, as a result of my travels. And to me, that's It's very solid evidence. It's very academic. It's very pure evidence. It's not. It's very difficult to refute that evidence once you once you see it and read about it and look at it.
The God self icon you talked about as well. This creature, this, I don't know what you want to refer to it as, this icon itself, does it have universal, how do I want to say this? Does it have a universal look to it as well from culture to culture, or do they all have a different look but same representation of it, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, the other, and you know, I published a chapter on the God self icon in Written in Stone, and my latest book, The Missing Link, is actually, I fleshed it out in The Missing Link. What the God self icon is it's a representation of a human being usually facing forward with arms outstretched, and there's parallel objects being held symmetrically in each hand. And this is a what I call the God self icon. This figure is present in every ancient culture. I can't think of one ancient civilization that doesn't have the God self icon representation. And in many cultures, especially in Peru and Egypt, it's one of the main symbols.
Well, that almost sounds like the triptych, right? You've got the main center is the opening. Then you've got the two dualities on each side. You've like, it's grasping those different dualities.
That's exactly right. And in the occult, the right side of the body, your right hand, is the solar, the sun, the yang side of you. And the left hand is the lunar. It's the yin side of you. It's the darkness. So the right side is the sun, the male, the light, et cetera, et cetera. And the left side is the moon, the dark, and the female, etc. And so the idea here is when you outstretch both hands like that, you're showing that you yourself, your torso, your head, your spinal column, that's the center. You're showing that you are a centered being and that you have found your center. You have transcended the material world. There's a lot more to it. I'm just giving generalities here. But it's an icon that shows that you have transcended duality. You have found your balance point. You found your center within. You know who you are. You've remembered yourself. And you no longer have the amnesia that is so prevalent these days in the Matrix times, I guess you could say. But yeah, the God self icon present in every single ancient culture. And, I show that in The Missing Link. It's an incredible, it's really an incredible discovery.
Any other similarities between the images aside from the God self in the center holding the two dualities?
Well, usually they hold serpents.
Okay.
You know, I'd say like 60% of the time they hold serpents. They also hold lions, twin lions. And the key is they're held symmetrically. It's almost like a mirror image side to side. And that's to show that just like yin and yang are mirror images, just like the night and the day are mirror images of each other, the sun and the moon. In Freemasonry, the Jachin and the Boaz pillars, there's two columns. One of them is the Jachin column. It's topped by the sun. And to balance that out is the so-called Boaz column. It's topped by the moon. And in between them, on many tracing boards and on a lot of Masonic symbolism, in between them is the third eye. And that's how you awaken the third eye. You balance the opposites to find the center. It all plays in together. It all fits in like a jigsaw puzzle. And it's not, you know, once you recognize it and once you read about it and look into it, all the symbols start to make sense.
It's funny you mentioned that some of these gods will hold serpents, yet in Christianity, in our realm, the serpent kind of denotes evil or forbidden information, forbidden knowledge. Where do you think that jumped the track? How did it go from being an image of power and an image of duality to an image of evil?
Right. Yeah. Well, a lot of the symbols were taken and the nature religions use the serpent. Okay, well, we'll make it the worst possible symbol that there is. You know, it's twisted around in the West. And that's something, it's a touchy subject, I know, and I don't like to get too deeply into it because I don't want to, you know, my nature is just, I don't want to be combative with Christians and that type of thing. But if you really study it, and I would recommend the works of Gerald Massey Alvin Boyd Kuhn. These are two scholars in the 20th century that did a tremendous amount of research into this, along with many others. They showed that Christianity is just it's very close to what this ancient religion taught, except that the teachings are inside out. There isn't just one Christ in the world. Every single one of us is Christ, and every single one of us needs to find our Christ within. And so, you know, it's in some way the teachings are there. It's just that they have been turned inside out, or the wires have been crossed. And so it's very difficult for somebody who's not aware of the esoteric or occult tradition to look at Christianity and see it as being legitimate, or see it as being a way that you can actually find who you are, or tap higher power. But if you do know the teachings, if you do know what these ancient cultures were talking about, then you can easily see in Christianity, or what we call esoteric Christianity, the truth. And real quick, what I wanted to say is there's a Masonic symbol. Actually, it's an alchemical symbol. It's called the Rebis, R-E-B-I-S. And that's a modern manifestation of the God Self icon. It shows a human being with two heads, a male and a female head, and that shows the balancing, or the uniting of the opposites. And the arms are outstretched. In one hand, in the right hand, is the symbol of the Masonic compass with a sun. And in the left hand, which is the female hand, there's a symbol of the Masonic square with the moon. And that's what I use as evidence to show, in part, evidence to show that the God Self icon with two arms outstretched are symbolizing, you know, the two hands are grasping opposites. And I think that's tremendous evidence, and really irrefutable if you see what the symbolism stands for. And it's not me inventing what the symbols stand for. It's me reading up on what the symbols stand for, reading the works of, you know, past occult scholars, and you know, Aleister Crowley, Dion Fortune, Helena Blavatsky, Manly Hall, Alan Watts. The list goes on and on. They all talked about the same thing, these same concepts. And so what I do is just, you know, I show the symbolic, I show how these symbols are proving what these past scholars are saying, past authors and past researchers are saying.
You know, just thinking about this, as you talked about this kind of center God-like self, the serpents on each side, and this kind of universal imagery, it reminds me of the Caduceus, the medical staff of healing, right? The when you think of doctors and prescriptions, it's that staff with the two serpents intertwined, and then on each side of the staff itself.
That's exactly right. That's exactly it. What you know, the twin serpents are the twin doors of duality of the triptych. They're the two serpents that are being held on in both hands by the God Self icon, and the staff itself is symbolic of the middle door of the triptych, the trunk of the human being who's found his balance, the torso and head of the human being who's found his balance. It's actually a symbol of the spinal column. In Kundalini Yoga, the idea here is that when we balance these twin serpents, or the twin energies on our left and our right, one of them is called Ida, that's the female, the yin. One of them is called Pingala, that's the male, that's the yang. When these twin energies are put into balance, it awakens what's called the sushumna, or it allows the sushumna to be activated, and that's the spinal, that it goes along the spinal column, and the energy goes from the pelvis up through the chakras and into the forehead to awaken the third eye. Again, we're back to the third eye, and this is exactly what Freemasonry is all about. This is the underpinning. This is the main thrust, and there's more to it, of course, but, right. You know, if you really want, you know, in my opinion, 60 to 85 or 90% of the teaching, that's it right there.
It also brings to mind, isn't that very famous imagery of Samson, right, standing between the two pillars, pushing them apart?
Yep, that's it. Yep. You know, there it is right there.
Right. Yeah. Gosh, just the way that now you start opening these things up, and it creates this whole onslaught of imagery that I think many of us have looked past. And it's kind of cool, folks. Go out. Now, when you're out exploring the world and you're seeing historic buildings and locations, start looking for this imagery, because it's, I think that's a really cool aspect of what you're out doing and seeing for yourself. You're putting yourself into these perspectives of history, and you're able to start seeing the commonalities between all of them. Talking about commonalities and the way all of these different systems look and work together, when you look into their societies, do they also have common beliefs on things like talk of the afterlife, ghosts and dying, things like that?
Well, the whole concept of dying is the same. I mean, look at the Egyptians, for example. Egyptologists will say that they were preoccupied with death. It's the exact opposite is true. They were preoccupied with the eternal life within themselves, which they symbolized with the Ankh cross. That's the cross that looks like the crucifix, except it has a little loop on top. That was one of the main symbols of ancient Egypt, and what it stood for was not just life, but eternal life. A lot of people think it just stands for life, like the life that we're living now. No, that's not right. The ancients saw our lives really as death, and the eternal life is the true spirit within you that was never born and never dies. A commonality that you'll find in modern esoteric thought is that we're all sort of living a dream right now. This is the material world, because it's changing, because it's constantly changing. You know, yin is converting itself into yang constantly, and yang is going back to yin. There's this constant shuffle back and forth between the opposites. According to this teaching, this means that the material world that we live in is not really real. It's not a reality. Reality then must exist in some other order of being. There must be a source where this has all come from, where the material world has come from, where we've come from. And so that's the idea that, you know, that is the underpinning of all the ancient religions, that we all have a source and it coming up from within us. And that's the soul within us. That's the spiritual. You know, it's not the material part. It's the spiritual part. The spiritual is the older part, the reality part. And the material is just sort of the lower part, the changing part. And that's what's common in all the ancient cultures. So when we die, it's like the dream ends. I like the way Alan Watts put it. He was a philosopher of the 20th century, and he talked about the idea that that we are God's dreaming, because we are omnipotent and omniscient beings, and you know, we have eternity on our hands, and what do we do with it? So we have dreams. And he says, well, what would you do if you were an omnipotent and omniscient being? You would have and you could dream anything that you wanted to dream every night. He said, well, in the beginning, you'd probably dream that you would have every all the gold in the world and all the material possessions that you would want, all the sensual possessions and everything that you would want. He said, but after a while, you'd get tired of that, and you'd want something of a thrill or an adventure. And then you would dream that you would have some type of thrill and adventure. And he said, as you would continue on, you would probably get tired because you'd know it's a dream and you could just wake up. But after a while, you would say to yourself, you know, I'm going to have a dream where I don't know it's a dream, where I don't know what any of this is about. And he said, you get further and further along until you have these types of dreams where you just completely forget that you're a deity. You completely forget that you're omnipotent, and you're just in it for the adventure and the fun and the thrill of not knowing what's going to happen. And that's what life is, according to what he says. And really what he's done with that idea is he's brought into the modern world a very ancient idea that's found in Hinduism, which is that we are God's dreaming. And so that's, and in order for there to be, the dream has different parts. There's a golden age, there's a silver, there's a bronze. It all works in together. And the golden age is the longest part, and it's the most beautiful. And then there's the silver age, which is not as long as the golden age, and it's not as beautiful. And then, you know, things get a little bit hairy in the bronze age, and it's a very short part of the dream. And then there's the final, the Kali Yuga age, which is the shortest and the most violent of the ages. And that's according to what the Hindus tell us, is the age that we're living in now. And so you see, it all works together. And if you look at what the ancients talked about, a lot of them had the same concepts. The material world is not real. We are the divine beings who are making this all happen through our own omnipotence and omniscience. This is what really Carl Jung talked about, what Joseph Campbell talked about. It all fits in together. All the true occult authors and the true esoteric authors, you'll find the same theme. And again, what they were doing was they were echoing the ancient cultures. This is what the ancients believed and talked about and wrote about in their myths and in their cosmologies, religion, etc.
When you visited any of these locations, have you ever had something you would consider to be a supernatural experience?
Absolutely. I was just in Italy about 3 or 4 months ago. Also here in Spain, I have a video online that on YouTube that I did about Tarraco, Spain, the Cyclopean ruins. And they have chambers. There's chambers, what look to be chambers. They're access points into and out of the ruins. And, you know, when you're in those chambers, you feel something very, very powerful. I felt an uplifting. I felt an uplifting of consciousness. I felt like a transcending. I felt very calm, very relaxed. I felt like almost like the onset of a drug or a buzz. And it just was a very peaceful feeling, it was an uplifting, and it seemed to me that these chambers were charged magically, charged with some type of a spiritual energy or a power. And it's just very difficult to explain, but you feel almost an ancestral love, almost like your grandparents had built that for you, and they did that because they loved you and because they wanted you to feel that feeling, that sensation, that higher uplifting power. I felt it in different places as well, not just in the Cyclopean ruins, inside the pyramids in Egypt. You get a strong feeling. If you're awake to it, you feel the same type of an uplifting feeling. And there's a lot of researchers who are talking about the reasons why that is. And they say it's because of the stone and the way the stone interacts with our blood and the magnets and this type of thing. I'm interested in that. I don't really see it. If I can't really find a scientific or a, you know, I can't really back it up with, mm-hmm. with, I can't really, I haven't seen any way that I could actually read that.
Well, what about ley lines? Ley lines is something that a lot of different researchers and belief systems have. When you look at maps of the locations of these ruins and these pyramids and places, do they fall in any kind of logistical pattern that you can look at? Or again, do you feel that a lot of people are forcing that to align to something they're trying to create?
I see both. You know, I see it getting blown out of proportion in a massive way, but you know what? There is some evidence for it, and so I do believe it. You know, I just think it's, you know, a lot of people hype it up too much, and they force it, and I totally disagree with that. I don't like that because, I think we should stick to the facts, and I think we'd be better off rather than hyping something up just to get people over to a website or a YouTube channel. And, I just don't like that type of research. But there is evidence. I mean, there is definitely evidence that the ley lines do exist, that ancient cultures built structures along ley lines, and that they did that because, these lines were charged magically, energetically, and that human beings could use this magic and energy through meditation and through contemplation even while they're on the ley lines. And so there is something to it, and I do believe it. It's just, I think, like you said, it's just been blown way out of proportion.
All right. You've talked about this and brought it up a few times, the Cyclopean ruins. And this is part of why you're in Spain currently, correct?
Yeah, the Cyclopean ruins for me are what I believe is what I'm going to be talking and researching about for at least the next 2 years. There are a number of what are called Cyclopean cities. One of them, I did a video on YouTube called Atlantis Ruins in Spain with a question mark. And the reason I titled it that is because when you see these ruins, they don't look human. That's just a very pointed way to say it, but they don't look like they were built by, according to what scholars say, they were built by the Romans. That's a completely impossible. The Romans didn't build that type of architecture. I actually lived in Rome many years ago. I used to walk. I did nothing for 3-4 months but walk around the city, take photographs, study the architecture. I've never seen any type of architecture like that in Rome. The Romans just didn't build that way. According to what the ancients told us, there were a group of giants in past history. And by giants, we don't know what that really means. It could mean, 7-foot tall, 8-foot tall. It could mean spiritual giants. It doesn't necessarily have to mean that they were, 12 feet or whatever it is. But according to what the ancient Greeks philosophers told us and historians and classicists, the reason why they're called Cyclopean ruins is because there was in ancient times a group of giants that built them. And these giants had what's called the Cyclopean eye. It's a third eye in the center of the forehead. And again, we don't know if they meant that actually physically, or if, again, it was a type of an analogy that these were enlightened beings, the shining ones or the enlightened ones or the powerful ones. And so across Europe, we have what these ancient historians called Cyclopean cities. They exist in Spain. There's one in Spain that I know of. There are several in Italy, and there are also in Greece and in other parts of Europe. And the reason why I'm actually living in Spain right now is because I'm studying these and I'm writing a book about them, and I'm also creating a documentary film on them. And I believe very wholeheartedly, and I found evidence for the fact that these Cyclopean cities were built by very, very advanced stonemasons, not the Romans, definitely not. And they were much, much older than the Romans. The Cyclopean cities, in my opinion, go back several thousand years before the Romans. I think the more I'm studying it, the more I'm starting to realize that the Cyclopean ruins are really the smoking gun of the fact that man was much more advanced in antiquity, and man at one point built these ruins or built these so-called cities and left their fingerprints of a higher advancement in these ruins. One other thing that's very interesting is these Cyclopean cities are walled in, and they're usually at in inaccessible locations. Sometimes, for example, they're at high altitudes. Sometimes they're in the middle of a body of water. And the reason for that, it seems, is because these beings, these Cyclopean beings, whatever they were, Cyclopean men, Cyclopean stonemasons, wanted to keep the rest of the population out. It almost seems like, and I don't want to say this as though I truly believe it, but I mean, it really shows to me that, and the reason why I call my documentary Atlantis Ruins in Europe with a question mark is, it almost seems like these beings were being hunted or trying to keep themselves safe by creating these walled-in cities. And the walls are massive, and they're built with massive stones, boulder-like stones.
Are we finding any kind of remains of the inhabitants of these areas?
No. And, that's another thing that I've started to look into, and with very, very little success. But what we do find is that their art and their architecture, the people who came after them, the Etruscans, the Romans, the Greeks, they learned from the Cyclops. They looked at the Cyclops as their forefathers. And so their symbolism became their symbolism. And, we find very powerful imagery from their ancestors, from their forefathers. And I talk about that in The Missing Link a little bit. I don't want to get too far into it on air, because it's very difficult to grasp these ideas without really seeing the art itself and showing the connection. But the actual Cyclopean ruins are tremendously advanced. I'm blown away by, first of all, the number of monuments that are left, how highly advanced they are, that the fact that these monuments look like they're several thousand years old and yet they're still in pristine condition in many cases. There's evidence that I've found that I have on video that I'll be putting forth in my documentaries that shows physically how advanced these ruins are. And, you know, it's just in being in them as well. This isn't really something that's scientific, but as I said before, sitting in these chambers, walking through these chambers, contemplating, meditating, etc., you feel some very strong power there. The people that put together these ruins were unbelievably advanced, and in my opinion, they were, if not Golden Age people themselves, then at least Silver Age or in some way remnants of the Golden Age.
Now that you're working on that, and you said that's kind of your focus for the next 2 years, do you have kind of a map out for where you want to go next and what interests you, or are you kind of coming to the end of the trail on the ancient civilization map?
No, definitely not. There's so much more that I want to do, and you know, I'm still finding pretty big discoveries, connections among cultures that scholars insist are unrelated. You know, there's a lot of leads in the direction that I want to go into. I just don't talk about it too much on my website or on my social media pages. I just want to keep that to myself for now, just because I don't want to put forward information until I'm more sure of that I know what I'm talking about. You know, I don't.
Wow, that's refreshing. Holding on to releasing information until you know what you're actually discussing. Well, exactly. I can't thank you enough. I mean, it's been fascinating to talk with you, and we'd love to have you back more as you continue to uncover more of these secrets and parts of our history that we've forgotten about. And for God's sakes, if you find Atlantis, would you at least give me a call?
I definitely will. You got a promise there.
All right, Richard. We'll have a link up to Richard on our website, and you can find it right there at the Beyond the Darkness page. You can also find it on iTunes and at podcastone.com with the explanation of today's episode. Thank you all for tuning in. Remember, tomorrow, Possessed Playthings. We've got Haunted Toys we're talking about with Ross Allison. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. Special thanks to our guest, Richard Cassaro, this evening for talking with us about the very cool and interesting histories of secret societies, of lost civilizations. That's it for tonight, folks. We'll be back tomorrow with more Beyond the Darkness.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.